Of course, we're coming today to what's been called spiritual receptivity. So up until now, in the exposition of the aspects of Dhamma life, according to Bhante, we've been stressing really willed effort, karmic effort. I've talked about this imbalance that emerges between what you are now and what you would like to be, and your exercise of your will to change the current so that you're working against the natural flow of instinct and reaction to develop something that is not there already and to cut out something that you want to get rid of. So that you're consciously altering the spontaneous flow of your energies. You're deliberately preventing yourself from behaving in certain ways. You're deliberately getting yourself to behave in certain ways. It's extremely important, and I hope I've sufficiently emphasised that importance. In integration, you're identifying more and more clearly your moral agency and exercising it more and more consciously. In positive emotion, you're directing that agency to shape your volitions so that they're more and more skillful. The consequence of this, if you keep on exercising karma in this sort of way, if you keep on working with your energies in this sort of way, is that you are recreated. You emerge in a different way. It's very, very important to understand about spiritual life, Dhamma life. I'm trying to stop using the word spiritual, it's so ambiguous. But in Dhamma life, it's very important to understand that you don't, as it were, make something happen. You set up the conditions in dependence upon which it will happen. This, of course, is important in the largest sense, that you do not create enlightenment, so to speak. You set up the conditions, enlightenment arises, Bodhi arises. And it's true all the way through. You work karmically to establish certain conditions. Something emerges, which is you, which is beyond what you were before. This is the mystery of the Dhamma life, that something emerges from what you are now that is more than what you are now. You establish the conditions now, out of that something new arises. So that this new you that gradually emerges from your karmic effort is a more refined you. In other words, your consciousness is more subtle, more able to see the nuance of things, the intricacy of things, the complexity of things beneath the surface, and indeed the simplicity of things beneath the surface. It's able to encompass the deep mystery of things. It doesn't just look at the surface, it looks below. This happens naturally. Your mind just emerges in that way. As you experience on a retreat, particularly a meditation retreat, you almost don't realise how different you are. And especially you realise it when you go back into the old situation and realise that it seems different to you. Seems different to you because you are different, perceiving it with different eyes. It's a more positive you. More positive in the sense of more energy. More positive in the sense of more naturally skillful, more naturally engaged with others, more naturally responsive, and so on. Happier you, because there's more of you in play, you're more whole, you feel more fulfilled. And so clearer you, you're less clouded by your own subjective confusions. It's a little bit of what one can expect, what one does actually experience, even with a little bit of karmic effort. What's so interesting is watching the fluctuations. When you make an effort, seeing the result. When you don't make an effort, seeing the result. When you have a moral holiday. Holiday's okay, but when it's a moral holiday, you can see it in the change in your own conscious experience, the way in which you are conscious. And when you do make an effort, especially over a period of time, such as on a meditation retreat, or periods of your life when you're able to practice in a consistent way, well, you do see the new you emerging. Sometimes, I used to experience this a lot when I was first engaged with the Dhamma, I'd experience almost different selves. You know, I'd experience the ordinary me, the old me that had been conditioned over, you know, 20, 25 years. And then I'd make an effort and I'd get into a completely different state. I'd experienced before, but in the meantime, I'd forgotten it. So that new state is actually a new me, which arises out of my karmic effort. The most important feature of this emerging new you, as karmic effort is made more and more intensively over a longer and longer period of time, is that it's more and more whole. As you emerge under the influence of skillful karma, you feel more and more whole. Life all sort of flows together. Everything seems to be part of a single unity. Your experience is more unified. The different aspects and functions of you are much more present together and even may not appear as separate. So you could say head and heart are not merely sort of in contact with each other, but seem to be united, as if they're one thing. Feeling is thought, thought is feeling. Feeling is intelligent, and a thought is full of feeling, of emotional charge, you might say. You increasingly experience yourself as a whole, and you respond increasingly to the world around you as a whole. And this, as I say, happens as a direct result of your karmic efforts. If you work with integration, you work with positive emotion, you begin to emerge in a more wholesome way. Instead of willing, you increasingly find yourself responding. This is really ultimately the resolution of the willful dilemma. As you emerge more and more wholly, you're less and less having to force yourself in a direction that some of your energies don't want to go. You're increasingly simply responding to the values that you see around you. So a new faculty or capacity gradually begins to take over within you. A faculty, you might say, that is neither thinking nor feeling, but that is both of them unified and transcended. So imagination or faith, you could call it. Faith in the Buddhist context is what we're talking about. But faith really is so much a specialized term for a responsiveness to the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha that perhaps it doesn't capture the full flavor. Maybe we don't really have a proper word for it. In earlier English usage, up until really the 19th century, the word you might use is intellect. You know, there's in Shelley, there's the hymn to intellectual beauty. It doesn't mean, you know, beauty of concept, as it were, although it doesn't exclude that. He means this whole responsiveness, which, of course, for the Romantics was summed up very much in the word imagination. And it's interesting that we don't have a ready word for this this kind of responsiveness. There's been some discussion amongst people who think in this sort of area. Henri Corbin, for instance, a very important figure in the recreation of imagination in Western culture. A very interesting French savant. He talks about the way in which our modern culture has lost the middle ground between experience and intelligence, intellect, as it were. It's lost that faculty that perceives beauty, that perceives truth, which is not, it doesn't deny experience in the sensory sense experience. It doesn't deny intellect. It fulfills and transcends them both. So we have within us the capacity for this sort of responsiveness. And that capacity emerges more and more fully, more and more articulately, you might say, as we cultivate skillful action. It becomes more and more who we are. Not merely something we experience, something we are. A capacity for responding to value. A capacity to respond, for instance, to beauty. You know, I talked the other day about the beauty of nature. You don't think about it. If you have to think about it, you've already not got it. You just naturally go out and open up to the beauty around you, to the sunlight filtered through the trees, to the cobwebs bedecked with dew in the mornings, as somebody pointed out to me and I delighted in the other day. You just respond. To the extent you have to think about it, or to the extent you have an emotional response, a narrowly emotional response, you've missed it. It's not beauty. To the extent that you want it, I want to take it home with you. Sometimes, I'm afraid, capture it with a camera. Sometimes capturing it with a camera can be a way of appreciating it more fully. Sometimes it's just a way of kind of collecting the experience. But yes, that sort of response, very spontaneous, very natural response that just comes from us when we see something that's beautiful in nature or in art, even in a human being. Friendship, real friendship, where you respond to the qualities in the friend. You just find yourself drawn to them, attracted to them, not because you want something from them, just because you admire them. I don't mean in the admire looking up at the sky at some great holy guru, as it were, but you just take delight in them. That's the term that Bhante uses, taking delight. Now, that's the characteristic of friendship. You take delight in the qualities of your friend. Well, it's the faculty that takes delight. Truth. I remember when I first read something of Buddhism, I read Khonsa's Buddhist scriptures, and I remember the nature of my response. I didn't think, although I was very struck by the content of what I read, I just felt. But even felt is the wrong term. I just responded. I knew this is the truth. And I would say that was at least a primitive version of this faculty coming into play. Nobility of action. You know, when you see somebody doing something that is really genuinely noble, maybe self-sacrificing or something of that kind. I often quote in this connection something I read in a paper a long time ago when I lived here, not on the tartan carpet, but in what's now Padmavajra's room. I remember reading about a plane crash in the Potomac in Washington, D.C., and an eyewitness description of the scramble to rescue people from the crash as the plane began to sink. And it described one man who'd, you know, brought out several people from the fuselage and just kept on going back and back. Even when the plane went down, he went down into the plane and he didn't come back. And I remember the sort of feeling of, well, intense admiration at that nobility of sacrifice. Without thinking, he just, about his own life, he'd just gone on trying to help people, trying to save people. And I was moved to tears in reading of that even. So it's that, again, that faculty of responsiveness that responds to nobility of action. Meaning in symbol and so forth. For instance, I talked about my delight in that Gregory Doran's production of Hamlet. And what I experience when I'm watching that is I'm just completely drawn into it and completely absorbed into it. And every word is striking into me and sort of almost physically affecting me. In fact, by about the third act, I'm exhausted. But yeah, poor old Hamlet is too. So it's that, a little bit of that, that responsiveness that I'm experiencing there, I would say. So it's not a thought, this responsiveness is not a thought, although it's intelligent. You know, I can respond to the deep, deep meaning in Shakespeare's words, but I'm not thinking about them. They're just going straight in. It's not a feeling, although it is richly felt. It's not a mere emotion, if you like. although it is richly felt. I can't find other words to make that contrast. It's not active, although it's freely moving. You know what I mean? I don't force myself to pay attention to Hamlet. I'm just drawn into it. At the same time, it's not passive, although it is open and receptive. So this quality of responsiveness is what begins to emerge when you really work on yourself through karma. It naturally emerges. You could call it love, even. You know, if we want to refer to our own European tradition, a great tradition, although that gets so perverted, it's that strong attraction. It's not ordinary metta. It's metta when it really becomes something spontaneous and, as it were, natural. Not the deliberate effort to bring about skillful volition under the positive emotion category, as it were. It's when positive emotion really flows that it becomes more like love in the classic sense. You could say it's an erotic power. And please be clear, I do not mean erotic in the sense that you will find it illustrated if you go to Google, put in erotic and press images. I don't recommend it if you want a nice good night's sleep. Erotic in an older sense of a powerful attraction of the whole of your being, not sexual at all, although, you know, it often may be connected with sex, or sex may be sometimes a sort of medium for it, but wait a minute there. Forget what I just said, although it's true. There's plenty of room for rationalisation. If we can rationalise spiritual death or spiritual rebirth as remarriage, we can certainly rationalise what I've just said. It's this sort of magnetic power that this when you see the beautiful sunset, you're drawn to it. It magnetically attracts you. That's what I mean by the erotic. In the Neoplatonic tradition, the erotic is the power that unites. The power that draws you to the highest truth. The power that engages you with the deepest reality. That's a very, very interesting reflection there. Those of you who know Botticelli's painting, there's some important paintings by Botticelli which illustrate the power of Eros. So Eros is this deep responsiveness that is whole, which is the psyche responding. A magnetic power which surges through us and drives us into relationship with whatever it is drawn to. Faith is, in Buddhism, its most characteristic mode. Faith which is that deep responsiveness to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, to the embodiments of the ideal. What Bhante calls the response of what is ultimate in us to what is ultimate in the universe. So something ultimate in us, not to do with I, not to do with will, a responsiveness that comes from below the level of feeling, even, you might say, that you just are drawn, and that it is drawn to something that you can never adequately put into words. You can embody it, you can illustrate it, but you can never define it. It's what I've been talking of as the myth. If you like, the personal myth is that something ultimate in us as it expresses itself in our own deeper experience. The public myth or the external myth is that myth as it's expressed. It's the ultimate in the universe as it's expressed in some situation, if you see what I mean. So when we break free of ego clinging, that capacity to respond to the Dharma, which is faith, becomes prajna. So this responsiveness is ultimately prajna. This responsiveness is first of all experienced as a responsiveness to value, to beauty, to, if you like, mundane value in the sense of good quality, real beauty, nobility, and so on. It becomes faith when it begins to be attracted to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and it fulfills itself in prajna. Our ordinary responsiveness, if you like, is a prefiguration of faith, and faith is a prefiguration of prajna. So this capacity is the vehicle of the Dhamma life. First as a distant echo of the Dhamma, not recognized as such perhaps. We see qualities, we see values, but we don't sort of see the deeper levels of them. You know, in the Neoplatonic tradition, you begin, well, even in the Platonic tradition, go back to the Symposium, you're attracted to the beautiful, to beauty in an individual, in Socrates' case, to a beautiful boy. We won't investigate that further and do all the, what are the political correct balancing up factors. Fill in the blanks yourself. Yes, there's a bit of responsiveness to beauty in another human being. But that beauty, Socrates argues in Diotima's dream, if you remember, becomes an attraction to beauty itself. This is beautifully illustrated in Bhante's poem, The Veil of Stars, which is very definitely a Platonic poem. So it's first of all a responsiveness to quality, to value in the universe around us, as concretely felt, quite ordinarily felt. Everybody has some twinges of it. Please let it be so. Pretty sure it is so. But if you live more and more for that, if you base your life more and more upon that, it gradually merges into a quest for quality on a higher and higher level, ultimately on the highest level possible, which is found in the Dhamma, in the Buddha, embodied in the Buddha as the expression of the Dhamma, and as embodied in the social world of the Sangha, in the communication within the Sangha. So it's a feeling for something better, for something more, something deeply true. Sorry, Tarkovsky. Anybody seen Stalker? Well, if you haven't seen it, see it. It's about this erotic urge for some deeper meaning, some deeper fulfillment. And it's about the way in which that fulfillment cannot be short-circuited. But enough of that. Yeah, you want something more, something really true, something that's deeply fulfilling. You know, when you see a film, for instance, and you quite like it, you quite enjoy it, but you're conscious that something hasn't been touched. And then again, sometimes you see a really good film and you find something in you is stirred, and that the images remain with you and that they seem to point to something further, something higher. I won't go through my roll call of great Tarkovskis, of course, at the top. Herzog, I saw some Herzog recently, and that sense that he's talking about something the images only hint at, and you can never close. So there's that difference of the feeling that what you're engaged with really doesn't get there, and then something that gets there but implies something more that lies beyond what you've witnessed. Eventually, that quality, which starts as a sort of distant echo, that responsiveness, which starts as a responsiveness to some sort of distant echo in the sense of an ordinary kind of beauty or nobility or whatever, becomes spontaneous. It becomes what we are. We become responsiveness itself. We cannot but respond to value. That, if you like, is stream entry. Stream entry is the point at which value is all we're interested in. And we see it wherever it is. This is the significance of Vairochana. His wisdom is the wisdom of Jnana Dhatu, the sphere of the Dhamma. So he sees it everywhere. That responsiveness is so... Well, he is that responsiveness. So he's echoing or quivering, so to speak, all the time to that... to the truth in everything. But to begin with, it's not spontaneous. It comes, it goes. We have it, we don't have it. And well, you know what it's like sometimes. You do get a strong sense of that kind of wholeness, and then it goes. And if you're at all sort of aware of what's happened, you feel it. You feel its loss. Well, like, rarely, rarely comest thou, spirit of delight. Shelley's experience of loss of inspiration, loss of that sense of intellectual beauty, and the pain of that loss. But yes, it's there, probably in everybody's life to some extent, unless you really do coarsen your sensibility, as many people probably do, and as the modern world does, it coarsens our sensibility. So we have very few opportunities for that sort of responsiveness. And it becomes something that you realise in conversation with people, they don't know what you're talking about. They have no inkling of it. Just even at the ordinary level of responsiveness. And what you often have to do is seek somebody's sort of point of departure, as it were. Can be football, for instance. After all, it's the beautiful game. Promudita? Yeah, there you are. You know, you often find with people, when you get them onto the subject of football, they're not just talking about their team winning. There's a sort of beauty and elegance. I'm not a football fan at all, by the way. I went to a public school. We played rugby. You know, they're clearly talking about something that's a little taste of that sort of delight. I with a friend recently who's a good Cockney Chelsea supporter. I'm sorry about that. And it's a fact. But I was forced to watch a game with him in which Chelsea won. But what I found really interesting was he was, you know, really delighted that Chelsea had won. But he just so enjoyed the game, the skill of it and so forth. So even in quite what might appear ordinary activities, people betray their sense of the erotic. I'll try telling John that next time. He seemed to have an erotic connection with football. I think he might hit me, actually. But but yeah, I think it's one of the arts of communication, is it finding where the erotic is alive for people, where they have that sort of responsiveness. It could be quite surprising. You suddenly find yourself in communication with them because you've got where the life is, that spontaneous responsiveness, that their eyes light up, their... You know, the weight drops away. They lose their clouds, as it were. The sun comes out. It's like that. And it's not anything very exalted. There's no Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and all that descending. It's just, you know, a beautiful kick, etc. Yeah, people experience this sort of erotic in quite a number of different phases. Probably the strongest experience that most people have of it in their lives when they fall in love. And particularly, of course, when she isn't exactly interested in you or not interested enough in you. That's a very useful phase for experiencing the erotic. Or even more effective is when she decides that you're not the man for her and you're left with your feeling, but no, not even hope, as you might say. So you experience this sort of erotic charge, of course it's got a sexual dimension to it, of course got a neurotic desire for affection and so forth, but something more, often, not always. The problem is that we then, if we're successful, we you know, sort of bury that charge in, oh, I've just realised there's a double entendre here, and we lose that charge in a perfectly ordinary human being. Decent and lovable though he or she is, they're actually just an ordinary human being. But Eros turns them into something, or through them Eros sort of comes to life for us. That's the problem with falling in love. And it's often that the sort of most powerful experience people get of this erotic charge, and it's the last time they really experience it. You know, you notice that you just suddenly become... you love everybody when you're in love, and you feel so generous and happy. Or even when you're in great pain from the other side of the equation, you feel great sympathy with everybody, and you can sort of feel everything. So that sort of erotic faculty comes to life, but it's so strongly connected with another human being, and that other human being is so strongly connected with, you know, an animal function and a whole social context, that it never gets really a chance to go beyond itself, unless you're so fortunate as to be turned down again and again and again. I recommend it. But you need strong nerves. So it's there in people's lives, it's there in all our lives, and it's really important to identify in your own life where the erotic is present. I'm going to use this word erotic, hoping that you'll all understand what I mean and won't rush off to Google. Unfortunately, there weren't little cupids going like that at all. So identify it in your experience. Identify that erotic element in your experience. Where is that charge? Where is that moment when you find yourself, well, almost a different being, functioning in a quite different way, seeing the world in a different way? No question of will, there's responsiveness. Well, we need to identify that, and then we need to train that responsiveness. Train for it and train it. But it's a very difficult topic. Of course, the easy side of it is the karmic work, because then you can use will. Although, even in our little discussions about willfulness, we've seen how tricky that can be. But, you know, the basic work of building a decent mind, as it were, through effort, is a way of allowing that responsiveness to become more and more part of you, or more what you are. Gradually makes us more whole and less selfish, less self-preoccupied, so that we can respond. But we need to actively cultivate that responsiveness. We need to make sure that in our lives there is a deliberate cultivation of that responsiveness. Even though, notwithstanding, I've said it's a responsiveness, not a willed effort, nonetheless, we need to make a willed effort to allow it to arise, not just by developing skillful states. I think probably the most important way is, well, just noticing it in your experience. Identify it in your experience. And it'd be very good if tomorrow you could all at least have a few examples of what I mean, of something in your life. And, you know, don't be proud. Please don't get confused either. But don't be proud. You know, just see, this is where some passion comes, some sort of sense of there's something more in this than merely the activity itself, merely the object itself. See where that is. So that's probably where it needs to start. If we don't do this, it'd be very difficult to bring it in later. And the great danger is that if you don't do that, you will create a dumber life for you, but it'll be sort of slightly apart from your inspiration. I remember a friend of mine saying that when he thought on his life, he thought that he'd had some inspiration for the Dhamma, which formed a sort of foundation. And then he'd built the edifice of his Dhamma life next door to the foundations. So what will have to happen then is, Milarepa-like, you have to knock it down and then re-erect it on a new basis. It's probably inevitable, because this willed effort has to come in, and it's very skilled work to keep that willed effort related to the fundament of your initial inspiration, and what really gives you delight and gets your energy moving. I think probably for most people, one of the chief practices, one of the things you can make yourself do that is most helpful for developing this sort of responsiveness is doing nothing. I remember Bhante saying that he wrote about one of his visits to India. He'd been leading a retreat, and while he was leading the retreat, I think Padmavajra was there, up at Sihagad. And the retreat was going on in another building, and Bhante was sitting in his hut, and he said he was just looking out into the blue sky. And he said, I was doing nothing, absolutely nothing. When I say I was doing nothing, I mean I was doing nothing. So when most people talk about doing nothing, they actually mean sitting daydreaming or planning or fiddling about or whatever. I was doing nothing. Very difficult. Very difficult, of course, because the mind drifts. But also very difficult because boredom sets in. And I think you could say it's boredom that is the key often to finding that deeper responsiveness. Boredom is a very, very positive mental state. It's not in the lists in the Abhidhamma, I know. Cultivate boredom. When you experience boredom, you're experiencing the lack of that responsiveness. And it's when you experience the lack of that responsiveness that it can begin to happen. You know the way in which you can, for instance, listen to a piece of music that you like very much and that usually draws you out, and you listen to it when you're very busy and your mind is preoccupied. You can't hear it. You can't feel it. It's just sound going on. In fact, it may be quite irritating. You have to be in a certain sort of relaxed and open, even sort of bored state. You might not feel it as boredom, but there's a sort of a disengagement from the ordinary activity, from your normal narrative self, and an experience of yourself just as there, just as open. I think the cultivation of nothing is extremely important. You'll find most people hardly allow a moment of rest. Even when they're resting, they've got a newspaper up, or nowadays, you know, they've got their tablet up or whatever, and they're fiddling away. Or, you know, they're just daydreaming. But to sit doing nothing is a very difficult practice indeed. It can be deeply humiliating, for a start, because you realise how empty you are. There's actually nothing there. That's good. That's great. Because if you can find there's nothing there, then it can fill. Something can come. But if you immediately try to fill it, you suppress, you deaden any quickening, inner quickening. So you need to leave a space, and often that means a space of boredom, a space of nothingness. Avoiding distraction, don't let your mind just go questing for something to engage with. Just remaining open, watching, waiting. Seeing what happens, seeing what arises, or seeing what doesn't arise. Not judging what's going on, just sitting openly. And of course, we have a practice that is intended to develop this, which is called just sitting. In some ways, I think the best way to do the just sitting practice is in an armchair, if you see what I mean. Because when you sit with your legs crossed and or folded on the ground, you can start thinking you're doing something. I think when you're just sitting in your chair and there's nothing going on and the next event hasn't started and the previous event is well over and you just sit there, that can be the most powerful form of just sitting imaginable. And I know that myself, I've spent long periods just sitting in a chair. It seems to be more effective. Not enough, I need to do it more, being inclined to activity. Just sitting is really just that. Bhante always resisted saying anything about just sitting. He used to just say, two things I remember. One was, don't try to do anything. Don't try not to do anything. Thank you, Bhante. That's absolutely clear now. Or he'd say, when we just sit, we just sit. Thank you, Bhante. Getting clearer and clearer. Nowadays, a body of teaching growing around the just sitting practice, including from me. But in some ways, I rather regret this. I think that it can then start filling that sense of complete openness, that in a way, you don't know what you're doing, because you're not doing anything. There are no rules, there's nothing, no guidelines. You are just sitting. I think that the rather puzzling challenge to the will is the very point of this practice. And myself, I've never had any sort of felt any need for any content to what you do. I suppose because I learnt it sitting with Bante. And it was very obvious when Bante would ring the bell and say, and now, session of just sitting. Don't do anything. Don't try not to do anything. Ding, ding. And somehow or other, I knew exactly what he meant, although it was very, very hard to do it or not to do it, if you see what I mean. But I knew there was a gap that he'd opened up that I needed to sort of, that I was kind of circling around. I'd make too much effort, I'd have to stop. Then I would drift, I'd have to bring myself back. But yes, I think it's a pity if one introduces too much of an idea of what you're doing, if you see what I mean. And I think as much as possible, just leave an open space. And if you think, oh, I don't know what I'm doing, nobody's taught me, great. Let that space open and sit in it. And have a sort of faith. Well, no, don't have it. A sort of faith will arise that something is there. You'll probably find at times a kind of humiliation because you see the triviality of your mind. You know, I remember this sitting in my armchair on my long solitary retreat 5 years ago. You know, you go away and you think you're going to have great thoughts and connect deeply with the Dharma. And all there is this sort of, I don't know, cocktail party going on in your mind. And sort of talk about gossip and, you know, how to do things. And, you know, I've got a terrible tendency to plan how to do things a bit quicker. You know, if I walk from here to there this way, I'll get there quicker than if I go that way. Or if I do this before that, if I put the teapot there. Incredible what time one can waste. God, I'm telling all about myself. But it's so humiliating. You know, you think, oh, I'm really into the Dharma. The Dharma is what my whole life is about. And actually, it's just a sort of two old ladies sitting on a sofa. I remember Maitreya Bandhu describing, I saw him the evening before his private ordination, and he was a bit sort of embarrassed. He said, look, I'm going to have my private ordination tomorrow. And I sort of feel as if I'm, you know, I'm leaning over a sofa and these two old ladies sitting there, and I'm saying to them, I'm going to be ordained tomorrow. That's nice, dear. Now, what were you saying about Mabel? One's mind is so much, it's just so trivial. But, well, there it is. And that's extremely humiliating and sort of disillusioning. But great, that's where we're at. But if you stay with that, if you stay in that boredom, that sort of humiliation, something will flow. I can guarantee you. Money back guarantee. Something will start to flow. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but eventually, before too long, something will start to flow. So I think it's really important to cultivate this conscious practice of letting a space be. Just sitting in the garden, just being there. Yeah, you look at the flowers, look at the clouds, but you're not sort of trying to get something from them or trying to capture the shape or find out what's going on. You're just looking, almost without deliberation. And let's see what happens. If you give that sort of space in your life, the problem of willfulness will disappear. Mm. Just disappear. Because everything you do will emerge from that openness, that silence, that lack of effort. It's, well, Bante referred to it in a very seminal discussion as the sphere of uselessness. So all our useful activity needs to be contained in a sphere of uselessness. This is amongst Bante's hidden teachings that Pabhavadra and I are going to run a series of courses at Adishtana on. We're going to start with a course on the erotic and the beautiful in the Dhamma life. You're just staying with this sense of a mysterious depth. Mystery is the essence of this state. A lack of closedness, a lack of clarity, but it's not unclear, if you see what I mean. A lack of conceptual clarity, a deep connection with things. So the essence of spiritual receptivity is this openness to mystery, the openness to possibility, the openness to what you don't know, to something new and unrecognized, which emerges, as it were, from within you, or descends upon you from without. Depends on your metaphorical point of view. So, yes, I think doing nothing, having identified it in your ordinary experience, and therefore encouraged yourself to take it further, just do nothing. Just sit, if you like, whether on your cushion or in your armchair, lying on your bed, as long as you don't go to sleep. Just sit, just lie, just stand, just gaze, whatever. Before you meditate, before you apply a willed effort, just sit. After you've applied willed effort, just sit. So that you've got an opportunity for what you've got from that willed effort to sort of resonate within you. Otherwise you jump up from the cushion, it's lost in the activity of the day. So surrounding everything with space, this is the essence of this phase, this aspect, spiritual receptivity. We can develop this faculty in other ways, of course. I've really mentioned quite a lot already the importance of art and culture, art perhaps more properly, the importance of nature. And again, it's worth noticing the actual experience that accompanies this. When I was thinking about this, for some reason, what came into my mind was an experience I had when I visited Singapore. I was invited there to give some talks. And for some reason, some of the people who were hosting us took me to an art gallery, which was full of Western art, which seemed a bit of a strange thing. And not the greatest of Western art either. So I was wandering around this gallery, sort of being polite, as it were, and not really connecting with anything. And at a certain point, I came into a particular room where they had some French Impressionists, and there was a painting, I think by Pissarro, of a Normandy harbour. It wasn't the greatest of paintings, but as I stood in front of it, I felt something happen to me. You know, I'm accustomed to this happening, but I never felt it so obviously. I suddenly entered the picture, and from being, you know, another canvas on this wall and wondering when we could politely move on to have some delicious Chinese tea in a tea house, I suddenly was engaged. This faculty of responsiveness had come to life. So notice that. Notice it happening. Notice that point when you're watching the film and the film is worthy of response and you find yourself engaged. The play or a piece of music, the dance, whatever it is. When you suddenly find yourself, well, as we say, transported. Because the character of this faculty of responsiveness is that it transports you. It's ecstatic. Wow. It's ecstatic. Carries you, well, ecstasis, be outside where you now stand, as it were. Friendship. And by friendship, I mean real erotic friendship. I say that advisedly. Less often experienced in the sexual context. Because the sexual context is a sort of, what can I say, poor imitation of that responsiveness. Not always, not necessarily. But one must be careful that the powerful animal charge doesn't sort of seduce you into thinking that you're having a profound experience when you're just getting your rocks off. Which can be, it's a good thing to do occasionally, if you want to. So when I say erotic communication, I mean a communication which is not sexual, necessarily or probably seldom, but where there's a meeting beyond personalities, a meeting beyond words, where you really feel deeply in contact with each other, and you're taking real delight in each other. You're carried beyond yourself. It's characterized by silence, for instance. It's those points in friendship where you fall into companionable silence. Not because you're lost in your separate thoughts, but because you're immersed together in some sort of experience that's come to life between you. So by friendship, I mean this. And Bhante one of the last conversations I had with him last year, was saying he thought that probably for many people, communication of that kind was the most likely basis for a real breakthrough. Because in friendship, you're a whole person relating to another whole person. An inspired study. I remember moments sitting in on that tartan carpet and in the wood, the room with the fire in it. I don't know what you call it nowadays. The retreat centre lounge. I remember, you know, sitting there with Bhante expounding the Dhamma. And I remember a couple of occasions just bursting out laughing. Just because I'd seen something. If anybody had asked me what I'd seen, it'd be difficult to say. And I could see that Bhante was fully with me in that moment. And I remember once he sort of commented on it. Subhuti's got it. So it's that when study sort of takes you right outside yourself and you see something, not just see in the sense of I'm here, that's there, but you almost become something of the Dhamma. The experience of Sangha can often be like that, or can be like that. I experienced this on the recent order convention in Bodh Gaya, despite myself, because Bodh Gaya is a crazy place to be, even though it's where the Buddha gained enlightenment, and there's some remarkable sort of depth to it when you're around the Bodhi tree. But Bodh Gaya itself is a mess, a horrible mess, really ugly and unpleasant, actually. But there's a sort of point at which you sense something in a room full of 500 people, 500 order members, and you sense that we're all united in something. Not united in any intellectual sense or even emotional sense. There's a mood or atmosphere that emerges from us that we're all merged in, at least the periods of time. So the experience of Sangha can be very powerful in that way. Maitri Vihara and I coined the term Sanghakaya, the body of Sangha, this experience of the Sangha as something tangible that you can sense. So we need to consciously cultivate this natural responsiveness as it emerges more and more fully. We need to deliberately identify it. We need to give the space for it by sitting doing nothing. And we need to engage in those activities that we've found do bring that responsiveness to life for us, where we pass over the threshold, as it were. This is the way I think of it. I think it is as passing over the threshold of access, if you like, into that state. As it does become fuller and fuller, more and more part of you, it more and more informs other aspects. Integration, the experience of effort in integration, is increasingly focused in it, so that your integration is an integration around that faculty, that responsiveness. It's, if you like, you could say that going for refuge is that responsiveness. And as you become deeper and deeper in your experience of integration, you'll experience more and more of that wholeness in the practices that are especially recommended for integration. So, for instance, with mindfulness of breathing, your awareness of the breath will pass from your, as it were, idea of the breath and your kind of idea of the breath as a conceptual experience to your direct experience of the sensations, to your experience of the subtle dimensions of those sensations, to the aesthetic quality in those sensations. And that, the aesthetic quality in those sensations carries you over the threshold, carries you through neighbourhood concentration into dhyana. Dhyana is that faculty of responsiveness functioning now, as it were, independently of the bifurcation of embodiment, of ordinary sensory embodiment. So the experience of dhyana in meditation is the experience of a new wholeness, still at the mundane level, but of that new wholeness. And this is why dhyana is so much stressed. I think what I'm trying to do here is enlarge the notion of what that wholeness means, so it's not simply confined to dhyana in meditation, important as dhyana in meditation is. You need to be experiencing that wholeness in other areas of your life. You need to be cultivating it there, especially because of the nature of our very complex and also rich cultural heritage. So, yes, when you as you integrate yourself more and more around this faculty of responsiveness, around this spiritual receptivity, you will experience in meditation more and more of jhana, or at least come closer and closer to jhana, or find yourself hovering on that threshold. The threshold is the threshold of the two, or the different aspects of you, the different streams uniting. When you're practicing positive emotion, you'll be increasingly experiencing that erotic desire for others' well-being rather than a mere wish for it. When you try to do Maitri Bhavana to begin with, Metta Bhavana to begin with, you're willing yourself to wish well to others. But when you really enter into Metta, it's quite spontaneous, it flows, and it's whole. It is, again, that responsiveness. So this faculty is what lifts us above the animal life of consumption and attachment. It lifts us above the ordinary life of birth, education, work, marriage, retirement, death. It lifts us above that into a realm of wholeness in which we can connect with real meaning, deep meaning. And we need to encourage its emergence more and more vividly in our own lives. It's what this whole Dhamma life is based upon. Everything we do can only happen if this begins to emerge. You cannot perceive the Dhamma if you do not have this wholeness. If you don't have this wholeness, you'll think about the Dhamma and you'll understand it, but you won't experience it. Or you'll feel for the Buddha, but you won't know who the Buddha is. But when this whole responsiveness emerges, you'll be able to really enter the stream of the Dhamma. This is what enters the stream of the Dhamma. Indeed, this is the stream of the Dhamma. You could say, as this wholeness begins to emerge in your experience, even when you appreciate the beauty of a skillful tackle in football, even then there's a hint of something more, of something transcendent. And, you know, the more that emerges, the more consciously it's sort of evoked, and the more it becomes a living part of you, the more that Dhamma Niyama processes are beginning to influence you. And eventually you enter the stream of the Dhamma, which is that flow. Our practice is essentially to get out of its way so that that responsiveness can respond. Because the responsiveness is spontaneous. When it's sufficiently highly developed, it just responds. When you enter the stream, you don't have to make an effort. You can paddle a bit faster, but whether you paddle or not, you're going to move. So yes, when we practice so that we can get out of the way of that stream of the Dhamma and let it carry us spontaneously out of this strong erotic attraction to Buddhahood.